Hello, and welcome to the Anxiety RX podcast, a show created by an anxiety specialist and neuroscientist, me, that offers unique, practical, and actionable advice to help you understand what anxiety truly is and exactly what you can do to empower yourself to resolve it. I'm your host, Dr. Russell Kennedy, an MD who suffered with crippling anxiety for 30-plus years, and traditional therapy from psychiatrists and psychologists really didn't help me feel better. And I also didn't like being on psych meds. In 2013, after burning out and leaving medical practice, I came to the conclusion that if I was ever going to heal my anxiety, I would have to do it myself. And that's exactly what I did, drawing from experiences with psychedelics and holistic healing, and combining those modalities with my scientific academic background in medicine, neuroscience, and developmental psychology. Here on the Anxiety RX podcast, I offer a distinctly non-traditional and non-medical approach to understanding and healing anxiety. So despite the fact I'm trained as a physician, in no way is what I say and suggest to be construed as medical advice, because none of the ways I use to resolve anxiety has anything to do with traditional allopathic medicine. From my own healing, I've created a distinctly non-traditional understanding and approach that helps thousands of people from all over the world understand and relieve their chronic anxiety. So if you're ready, let's get into today's episode. Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Anxiety RX podcast. I am very excited today to have a very special guest with me who saw my book early on and helped me put it into the world. And she's fabulous and amazing, which we discussed before we went on here today. She's the author of her second book now called Becoming Free. She is a book doula and the CEO, manager, owner of Awakened Village Press, which published Anxiety RX for the first time, which is now up to 80,000 copies, Amanda. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Russ, for having me. I am celebrating you and, of course, so delighted to connect with you in this space and on your podcast. So thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we're going to get real, talk about personal, talk about my breakdowns during the book and how difficult that was creating a book and, you know, how you saw me through it and how you see authors through it and talk about our own anxieties and about how, you know, we kind of move around. We try and avoid our anxieties in so many ways. And I know I'm not saying you're avoiding, but I've known you in Costa Rica. I've known you in Italy. I've known you in DC where you are now. And I'm sure there's other places as well. So why are you bouncing around so much?
Are you implying I've been running away from something?
I don't know. That's how I started. That's my intuition.
I think you're onto something, Russ. I think I was for many years. I don't think I would say I was running away from something so much as chasing after something, which has a very similar sensation. And as an anxious attachment style, that actually fits me more than the avoidant running away. Mm-hmm. I would chase the thing out of anxiety for if I don't, it will forever elude me. It will forever be something that I will never have. And I think there was some very real unconscious, of course, patterns of that for a while, though I addressed just a couple of them in my new book. But it is this idea that I think, you know, I was talking to someone the other day. I think you might appreciate that. You probably already know this, but time is what creates anxiety. This idea that the minute we start a clock, oh my, I have an hour left. I have 10 minutes left. I have 20 years left. I have 1 year left. I'm sure for the first, you know, for not the first 20, for the second 20 years of my life, I was running towards something out of fear that if I didn't, then I would lose it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us have these childhood coping strategies, right? And it probably worked. Like as you were a child, what did you run towards and it worked?
Oh man, that's a great question. I would run to theater. That was the first thing that just came to me.
Right.
I became a performer, which was a constant, it was constantly changing. I mean, there was always another show, another performance, another thing, right? So I got to keep running out of the house and into, you know, connection with other people, being seen, being in the spotlight.
And what cues you like when you're in a place? Because I've seen you bounce around quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So what cues you? It's like, screw this place. I'm out of here. Like,
ooh, you're going to like this.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
Because again, I do talk about this in my latest book. And it's so funny how this is immediately connecting. I didn't know how much it would. The minute I start to feel deep connection for a place, I start getting scared. And I feel like it's time to go. It's actually the deep connection. So when I say I'm chasing things, of course I'm also running away from something, right? But I don't experience it that way consciously. I remember in Costa Rica, I'd been there for a little over 2 years. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling this deep, deep sense of belonging and connection to these people that mm-hmm. I was developing really like big feelings for, like family, like familial feelings for. And I knew my time in Costa Rica would eventually have to come to an end.
Right.
And so I just beat it to the punch and I left.
So are you one of those people that breaks up with someone before they break up with you?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Although I haven't had a chance to do that in a long time. So that's maybe an old pattern. My new patterns are just, you know, not even letting someone start dating me to break up with.
Right. Yeah. Well, as you know, I do a lot of my work intuitively, right? So if I get into spaces that are a little uncomfortable, just say, hey, let's just talk about something else.
I'm here for it.
Yeah. So I guess I want to go into my book a little bit about how in 2019, I kind of had this idea for this book, which is in front of me right now, which I'm going to hold up.
Yes.
There it is.
Yes. So beautiful.
So, and I also had the idea of writing it in 108 short chapters, like Eat, Pray, Love. So I mentioned that to you and you told me it's going to take us a little longer if we're going to do it in this framework. And it did, but it's been really worth it, you know, and just sort of having you see me through it because I've done the second edition now. So I've sent the second edition off to the publishers in the UK and the US. And the second edition was so much easier to write than the first. I didn't have the self-doubt. I didn't have a lot of the, is this going to, you know, resonate with people? Because I knew it already did. So then the second edition now, it's actually about 40% different than the original one because I've been on about 150 podcasts in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it's like I've refined the message over and over so many times that when I read the original book, I think, geez, you know, I could have said that so much better. And I had a chance to do that in the second book. But none of this would have happened without you.
Mm, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I love that what you're speaking to feels, I mean, wow, what a gift. So many of us, first of all, so many of us don't do the thing. We talk about this, I think, well, you talk about this in your book, and we talked about it a lot on the journey of writing your book of especially those of us who experience anxiety, which I have to just say, I think everyone does. We don't even do the thing because we're so afraid, right, of finishing it or completing it, or it's not going to be, you know, perfect, or gosh, what if I don't say something that, you know, that I wish I had said. So so many of us put up all these obstacles and reasons not to complete something.
Right.
And I think what a tremendous gift that you had the opportunity to complete it. And then you got to go back and make changes and revise it and try it, do it again. And I mean, that is a true gift. And of course, it also highlights that even, and I want to acknowledge this, even though you had the self-doubt or that fear or that anxiety in the process, again, which is so normal, it still has sold over 80,000 copies. Like it is still resonating with people. It's still, so even in the fear that it wasn't, and even though you've changed things, your first attempt was still very successful and very impactful. And I think that's also something for all of us to remember and take note of.
Yeah, I argue with that, or that I don't argue with you. I'm just saying that that whole, this is going to sound very pretentious, but I think it was Voltaire who said, the perfect is the enemy of the good, you know? So, and it is. I mean, there's points where I look back, even at the second edition, because I've been through the second edition a good 3 times, and that's how I got through med school. I went everything, once I was sick of it, it was like, I knew I was ready to write the exam or do whatever. Mm-hmm. So once I was sick of the second edition, it's like, okay, it's done now. But I could still go back into the second edition and I pick random places and I go, you know what? I could actually change this sentence. I could actually put another word might go better here. It's not as frequent, but man, it's like a never ending thing. Mm-hmm. So it gets me into my own like perfectionistic, that perfectionistic part of my personality, like this is me going out to the world. Like, how are people going to perceive me? I want to control
how people look at me, how people perceive me. Because one of the things when I was young was my dad was, you know, tremendously emotionally sick, as you know. And then I went through episodes of bullying at school for sure. So there was this sense that, you know, being out there is vulnerable, like really vulnerable. I know, I'm sure every author goes through this. But I was just surprised at how much easier the second edition was to write because I didn't have that self-doubt, you know, on my shoulder every day. And one of the things that I'm grateful for you for this day was kind of, you know, babysitting me through those periods where it's like, screw it. It's too much. I'm not doing this anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So, because it took us about 18 months to write that book.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm so grateful that you saw it through, as I know now thousands and thousands of others are. And some of them that I've even had the pleasure of talking with and meeting along the way. So you've really, again, I'm grateful that you stuck it out. And I believe, oddly, and maybe that is part of my anxious attachment. Like I just don't let things go. I have a clinging personality. And now I think, and I call it, you know, call it tenacious, call it persistent, or just call it, you know, clingy. But there is this, like, I feel that on behalf of other people as well, I feel at times.
So where does that clingy come from, Amanda?
Again, that fear of I know everything is, everything will one day, I will lose it. It's interesting because I have not actually had, and I don't remember if you and I talked about this, but you know, I haven't had some traumatic loss in my life.
Right.
As so many people have already experienced. I'm kind of coming in like, what am I so afraid of? And yet, of course, there's something so deep in me. Maybe because I haven't yet. And I don't know how, you know, maybe it's the unconscious, how am I going to handle it if it does happen? Right. But there is this, need to hold on.
Yeah. And that artistic part of your personality, right? Like the shows are, they're very intense. You're very connected to them. And then they end. And then there's a grief. But you can handle the grief because it's kind of, when a show ends, it's like it's a happy ending, you know? Mm-hmm. When a relationship ends, it's often not happy ending. I have a friend, Lee, and he goes, you know what? And he said this like 30 years ago to me, if it doesn't end badly, it doesn't end at all. So that's kind of how it goes too. So I see your artistic temperament and you know, how does that come out in your latest book, in Becoming Free? Like what are you releasing to the world?
It's so amazing. I just even said, you know, I hold on to a lot of things. And in a way, that's what this whole book was about, is the fact that for so long, actually, I refused to hold on to like, I used to think freedom or non-attachment, right, meant not to hold on to anything. Again, this whole book explores, what does all of this mean? What does attachment mean? What does non-attachment mean? What does it mean to let go? What does it mean to be free? And I think I, through all of this, probably because of my theatrical upbringing, because I actually did experience divorce at a very young age. I mean, I was 24 when I was divorced. And so I actually had some things in my life early on shape my perspective of how things go. And essentially, I realized that I, again, unconsciously then didn't hold on to anything. I mean, again, other than relationships. So I have like this, I was holding on to relationships, but there was, you know, I was getting rid of stuff. I was leaving apartments. I was quitting jobs. I was moving. Mm-hmm. And so there was this, I didn't feel as attached to things, or I believed I wasn't attached to things. But one very wise person at one point said, Amanda, you're attached to non-attachment.
Oh. Was that me?
Attached to not, like, I was so attached to not being attached to anything.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Like I was above that. It's like I was better than being attached. I was like, oh, geez.
Right.
So again, I really spent the last nearly decade exploring what does that really mean? And so now, you know, the subtitle is from letting go to embracing it all. So I can feel everything and be with everything and still, you know, feel free. So that's the evolution.
Yeah. Well, that's what I talk about too in Healing from Anxiety. Like my little mantra is like sensation without explanation, right? Because we're so quick to go into our heads and find a solution for something. And I put solution in quotation marks there. So that's what I do. It's like, I just go into, if I'm feeling angst about something, or even if I'm feeling happy about something, it's like, where do I feel that in my body? Can I allow that sensation? Because so often we don't pay any attention to the good feeling. We just assume that that's going to last forever, and we know it doesn't. And then it's funny, like a bad mood can last days to weeks, but a good mood lasts about 12 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of how our brains are wired. And if we can sort of bypass that compulsion to believe that we can think our way out of a feeling problem, we can start seeing a whole bunch of things that actually come out into view that we never would let ourselves see before. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday about this too, is that he says, well, you know, you have this blind spot. And I said, well, so do you, not to, you know, sort of become 5-year-olds, but it's like, we don't see our blind spots. So we either have a counselor or a friend or whatever that can show us that, or we just go about our lives and just keep making the same mistake over and over again, wondering why we're just not evolving. Mm. And that we have this huge unconscious blind spot that we don't want to touch it. So when we go into sensation without explanation, we can kind of, it's sort of a way station. We can go into that feeling in our body surrounding whatever thought that we're telling ourselves and see if we can metabolize it. Because if we don't metabolize it, we're always going to be stuck in our heads trying to figure it out. And yeah, we'll never figure it out. It's like it's not figure outable in our heads.
That is exactly it. I think that was what I started really noticing, is how much of my life I've been trying to figure out. I think that's why I really resonated with you and the topic of your book so much, because it really, you know, made sense. It resonated with me. I feel like lately I've been shown thing after, like, experience after experience that I just can't make sense of. It's as if I'm having to learn that some things just don't make sense. And as an analytical person, as an intelligent person, which we both are, that's really hard to swallow. And I think that's to your point, that is the sensation without explanation. I think that, and that's so brilliant. That's something, of course, that's so useful from your book and your teachings. And I've been just putting it into my other words. I listen to a lot of Alan Watts. So he's playing in my head. Yeah. So he's very much an informant of this text. And so he talks about, you know, life is insoluble. We cannot solve it. It is not to be solved. And so that's where I try to just come back into, all right, maybe I don't need to figure this out. This is, can I just be? It was my, can I let it be? That was my mantra. Let it be. Let it be.
Which is the same as sensation without explanation. Yes. So one of the other things that I say, you know, when something doesn't make sense, that's when you go into sensation. Like that's exactly sensation. That's what you do, because you're not going to find the answer in your head. You're not going to find peanut butter in a tree. You're not going to find, you know, I don't know. You're not going to find a printer in a hardware store. Like don't look for something that isn't there. But when we were children, typically, and when we were kind of victimized, when we were in situations that were out of our control, the only place we had to go was our heads. We could only dissociate because our body held all this old trauma and all this old pain. So what we have to do, in my opinion, is go back to that sensation and just dip our toe in it. Come in. You don't have to, you know, people say, oh, you have to sit in your trauma. You don't actually. You have to go into it, and you have to willingly go into it. And that's the thing about what I like about cold plunges, is that you're putting yourself in this painful situation, but you put yourself there, right? Yeah. Whereas when you were a child, you didn't have any, there was no choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. So when you put yourself into pain and you stay there, and like when I come out of the cold water, it's like, okay, I've got 15 more seconds. I can't just get out. I've got 15 more seconds. And at the end of 15 seconds, I can get out. And it's like, that builds capacity and resilience in your nervous system that shows you, you know what, I can handle discomfort. Because typically what happens to those of us who are anxious is we assume we can't handle the discomfort, mm-hmm. and we run up into our heads every time. And if the issue is this sensation in our body, and every time we feel that sensation, we run up into our heads, that sensation never gets dealt with. It never changes, because we never spend enough time with it to change it.
If only I could apply this to when I first date somebody.
Okay. There you go. That'll be our next book.
I guarantee it will be. Yeah. Though, you know, it's so funny because I love a cold plunge. I'll go in that thing for 3 minutes.
Yep.
No problem. The minute I feel the discomfort of am I going to hear from this guy? Like, is he going to, I really want to text him, right? Oh, I need to, and I feel all this discomfort, because all of it is simply uncertainty. It's my, and I mean, there's, and then of course some traumas and wounding in my body. And at the end of the day, it's just because I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
I don't know what's going to happen next. Uncertainty. It's unknown. And that discomfort feels so unbearable, which is what triggers my anxiety, my anxious attachment style. And it's so fascinating. So I'm thinking, it's really the area of my life where I have the most anxiety. And I mean, I can live with like $50 in the bank account and be like, it's fine. Everything's gonna be fine. I don't know where it's coming from, but it's coming. I mean, it's like every other area I've not mastered, but I have come into some deep,
knowing.
Like, yes, knowing. And ooh, you put me in front of a boy, I clam up. I didn't even clam up. I just start vomiting.
Well, here's a big question for you, Amanda. I'm going to just dump this on you. Now you can handle it. So what did love mean to you when you were a child? Like, did you feel safe with love, or was it something that was really uncertain? Because for me, with my dad, I mean, I loved him. He was great in so many ways, but then he would go psychotic. So what I learned was, unconsciously, hey, it's not safe to trust love, right? Mm. So there's no wonder I've been divorced twice, right? Like, it's one of those things that if that's what you grow up with, and then you so badly want it at the same time, and then we develop these fantasies like this person, this love interest is actually going to heal my anxiety, when it's really up to us to heal our anxiety. And then it's funny, then the love comes to you. It's just, it's so weird, the energy that we put out, you know, avoidance, anxious attachments, all that kind of stuff. It's so funny. Like, people don't come together at random.
And it is an energetic, and and I'm going to answer your other question here in a second, but I'll just say that it's like, I'm aware enough to know that once the energetics in my body shifts, I will attract exactly what I'm looking for. Yeah. And yet I can't force it. Like, I cannot force the energy to shift, right? Which is another part of I need to figure this out.
Well, do you know what you're looking for? I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think we know what we want, but is that really what we want? That's Mary Allen was. Do you know what's in life, or is it something that's outside of you? And why are you looking for something outside of you when it's already inside? That's my Alan Watts impression. And my cold is certainly helping with that.
You do sound awfully similar. I'm like, did he just return from the dead? You know, I do believe I know what I want, but we're going to put a pin in that. I'm going to come back to it, because actually want to answer, what did love mean as a child?
Exactly. It's a big question. A big question.
I love my parents dearly. And if my mother listens to this podcast, you know, my mother, I'm sure she'll be very fine with me saying this.
Yeah.
I'm just now putting a little piece of the puzzle together. This is why I want to say it. I grew up listening to her, and probably witnessing it as well, tell me that she did not love my father. Mm-hmm. And yet they were in this marriage. I mean, they've been married 50 plus years, 55 years. So in my mind, I just kept, and I'm sure some of that also came at me. I know that there were times where she'd lose her temper. I mean, again, I think nothing more than a typical, I can't handle this right now, and I'm going to throw a pan. I don't know, whatever.
Right.
But like, it was probably enough. Although what I really sense is, if my mother doesn't love my father, then how can I try? Like, I have to I have to chase that. I'm going to have to
go for it, baby.
I'm going to have to
go for it.
That is obviously not safe. Like, that isn't guaranteed. So there's something there that, of course, love may not have felt safe even as a child watching my parents. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't. And that's true for so many of us, for sure. You know, love's never going to be perfect ever. Right. Mm-hmm. But it is one of those things that if you get it good enough and it's solid enough and you can stay enough in it, then you're okay. But if you don't get that, if you don't get that feeling that love is safe, or the other thing that I'm seeing a lot of now is, were your parents able to repair? Mm-hmm. Like, or was it a big blowout? There's that period of like, it's what's going to happen. Then there's a bit of a connection back again, but it's not really a holistic one. It's just kind of a one out of necessity. And then the whole cycle starts itself again, as opposed to, you know, mom or dad saying, hey, look, you know, sorry about that. I kind of lost my marbles there for a minute. We still love each other. We're still connected. Like, did you witness repair as a child? right?
I bet I didn't.
Mm-mm. No, either did I. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah. So it's one of those things that, so if you don't ever witness repair, you don't see that potential of repair. And that's so important for your nervous system to be able to go into this high sympathetic fight or flight situation and then come back down. I don't know if you remember chapter 50 in our book, because you've been through many, many books since then, but it's basically the chapter is called Sea Monster. So this chapter is about when I was in medical school and Leandra, who was about 3.5 at the time, would run into the room and she would yell out, "Sea Monster." And I, being the sea monster, would jump up and just chase her around the house. And she would scream in fear and just, and then I would run her around for about 2 minutes, which was a lot of time. You know, sea monsters need to do more cardio. But and then at the end, we would have this cuddle on the couch. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but what I was actually doing was I was actually calibrating her autonomic nervous system. So I could take her up to like 90, 95% autonomic and sympathetic and then bring her right back down again. So I was teaching her nervous system, yes, you can get into this elevated state, but you can also come back relatively quickly to normal. And those of us with anxiety, we go up really fast, but it takes us a long, long time to kind of come back. And that's why seeing repair is so important for children. Because, you know, I see relationships among people, and the relationships that have fights and have repair are much stronger than the people that say we never fight.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. I can see that. Yes. That's fantastic. Yeah, and I'm sensing, I don't even know. I mean, I want to, anyone who does not have to navigate being single right now, I just bless you all. Bless you all. there's really, I think, something, and maybe because so many of us are dealing with these traumas and anxieties, and we're not doing a great job, I gotta say. There's a lot of us who are just flailing out there, and it's tricky. It's tricky.
Yeah, people are feeling more and more separate. You know, yes. Gordon Neufeld, my mentor in developmental psychology, used to say this all the time, which is basically all anxiety is separation anxiety, which it is. And I think it's just so hard for both men and women. I think women are becoming more empowered in a lot of ways, but in a way, they're taking their power away from men. In a way. So, yes. So the polarity is decreasing. So it used to be there was the feminine, there was the masculine, and they would come together energetically. And you've got a big woo-woo side. So I know
I'm here.
So the less the polarity is there, the less the attraction is there. And we're seeing that. So men are getting their interactions from like porn and OnlyFans and the internet and guns and cars and whatever it is. They're not, so many men are like, you know what, I've kind of had it with women. And especially if you look at the marriage contract, you know, how it kind of, we're starting to see so much more how men get really, I mean, women do too. It's not like it's all one side, but men really get hit when, so one of the things I heard the other day was like, don't get involved in a contract when the other party is rewarded for breaking that contract.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's part and parcel of people aren't coming together. I'm going to say one more thing here is that when my eldest stepson or youngest stepson was going to high school, I would pick him up sometimes. And, you know, when we went to high school, there was probably about 50% of the people we would see were couples walking around, and about 50% of people were just, you know, milling around by themselves. There's like so few couples now. Like there's just so, like the couples are conspicuous by their absence. There's not, people aren't coupling up anymore because I think this price of attachment, this price of connection is so high, and we have such expectations of the other person kind of to save us from this, you know, existential angst that we're all going through. The pressure on relationships is so massive that it's really hard to be able to be in a relationship and not have those expectations because we are looking for something that will save us.
Oh, so well said. I'm thinking about a chapter in my book. Yep. And I'm going to show my, look at how
okay,
pretty
yeah, there we
book
go.
Is.
Look at
there
that.
Go. So there's a part, I talk about this because I did realize, again, unconsciously or unwittingly, I was also expecting a relationship to save me. I didn't,
me too.
And I thought, it's going to save me from feeling all these awful feelings that I feel when I'm alone. And then I'm like, oh, wait, I'm going to actually have to be more vulnerable. I'm going to actually see, someone's going to see more of my humanity. Someone's going to see more of me deeply. And that's actually only going to bring me into a deeper state of what it means to be human versus it saving me from all these right. human feelings I don't like. So I certainly can't say that I have now experienced that, but I had a wake up moment. I was like, oh my gosh, I too have been putting all of these expectations on another, which is also part of that anxiety and that anxious attachment. Now, what's interesting is I will still meet people and they'll say like, no expectations, no expectations. I said, I said, I'd love to aim for that, but let's also be real. Of course we have expectations. Like that's part of it too. And I'm not going to lie and pretend I don't. And I'm going to be aware of the expectations I have. And it's no longer for me to now escape what this means to live this human life, but rather, just to have the expectation of being met with kindness and love and, right. you know, passion and other expectations that might come with a relationship.
Yeah. So my little intuition is screaming at me, and you don't have to share this, but what was your wake up moment? What was it? Or can you share it? If you can, it's okay.
I mean, I'm trying to think if it was a single moment or if I mean, I know I was in Italy. It was a collective. It felt like it was a building up of that. I mean, it was just like one after another of these letting myself be very, very vulnerable and intimate with a person, just, you know, sharing myself in all these ways. And then having that just be taken away from me or cut off. And I think just this over time and reflection and spending a lot of time alone going, wow, what I now see what I'm really afraid of. I'm actually afraid of someone. It's weird. It's like I didn't realize how afraid I had been for someone to truly see me. Mm. So that was a whole nother revelation. But yeah, these things usually come in like little drops for me. And then it's like the last drop in a bucket and then it all overflows.
Right.
And it's like, oh, now I see it.
Right. Yeah. And then still, you probably don't fully see it either because it's so emotionally close to us. You know, I have that program too. And I've talked about that on the podcast before. It's like, it's all going to get taken away from you because that's what I would have as a child. My thing was like, things would be going pretty well. And then, you know, for 12 months or so, my dad would be better. And then all of a sudden he would start to go manic or start to go depressed again. So there was this sense, like, don't let yourself get content because it's all just going to get ripped away from you. Right. And so many of my anxious peeps have the same thing. Like there is that expectation. We do have this mesolimbic and mesocortical dopamine system that's always like, hey, this sunset is really nice, but it would be way nicer if I was in Maui, which is all dopamine, right? Serotonin is like, this sunset is amazing. I love this. I could just, I don't need anything more. I'm content. And then dopamine comes in there and goes, you know what? You know, you could be in some faraway place right now, really enjoying this. Like, this is okay. But so that's that whole dopamine circuit again. And I think dopamine is kind of what's crushing our society right now because it creates motivation to do things. Absolutely. But it also fuels these expectations, these unconscious expectations that somebody else can never fill. So it's like, how do you take everything away from yourself, Amanda? Like, that's what I would say. If I was, you know, if you and I were working together, that's what I would say is like, how do you take everything away from yourself? You asked to come on the show, so you're getting it.
No, I know. This is bringing me back. Actually, you're right. I'm sure I still don't see all of it. But last January, so over a year ago, I think I was in a dark night of the soul that was basically something asking me that question, which was, what if I just take all of this away? Like, no, because what I felt, what was the hardest thing for me to sit with after I felt like one thing after another had crumbled, like the man that I thought I was eventually going to be with, and I'd spent years like imagining this was going to happen. Once again, just, you know, puts up the walls. My business that I thought was growing also had a bit of an implosion, right? So there was like all these things that I thought were finally coming to fruition, right? All of these, look at all these good things happening. And then, I remember at that point thinking to myself or feeling, the pain wouldn't be so bad if I didn't want these things to begin with. So do I just have to stop wanting? Is it time to let all of these desires go, right? And that was a really shitty place to be. Because I was like, well, then what's the point? Really? Yeah. Truly, what's the point? Desire gets us out of bed in the morning, right? It motivates us, to your point. Dopamine motivates us. It also is a real bitch because it's going to also keep us on this like, well, what about that? What about, well, that would be better. That would be better. That's talk about, again, online swiping. Yep. Like there's always another and another and another. And the dopamine alone, just to get excited about the potential of somebody, is beating out the real feeling of trying to meet someone. But I think that taking it, if I were to lose it all myself, that's what it felt like. And I can tell I don't want to go back there.
Right.
But that was it. It's like, what if I just lose these desires
right.
or lose these hopes? And that's tricky to navigate.
Yeah, because who would you be without the person that you've known for so long? And that's kind of how I had to. And part of, you know, writing my own book was like that, too. Like, can I release this image of being a doctor and kind of being, I mean, I'm still a know-it-all, for God's sake. I'll always be a know-it-all, but I'm aware of it. Like, I'm aware that I do it, right? So I can like laugh about it and sort of admit to it and that kind of thing too. But there's a blind spot there. And like I said earlier, there's a huge part of me that's very, very concerned with how I appear to other people, which, you know, I get that from my mother, who gets it probably from her mother. Because I noticed it the other day when I was talking to my mom. My mom's 90 now. And good days and bad days and that kind of stuff. We were having a conversation about 2 weeks ago. And I really noticed how, like, oh, well, she's in this, not in a nursing home, but she's in kind of like this facility that kind of looks after her in a way, but she's still pretty mobile and stuff. Like how paranoid she is about how everybody perceives her. And it's like, holy shit, this is me. Like I am the same. I am the same way. Now I have a lot more awareness around it than she does. And I can kind of, what happens with me is like when someone turns me down or whatever, it's like, I say, okay, where do I feel this? Like, where is the feeling for me of rejection? And it feels kind of like the same as bullying, like solar plexus, that kind of stuff. That's where I have all my alarm just about. And it's like, can I just sit in that feeling? Because I noticed that when I sit in the feeling, it's not so bad. But if you have the feeling and the thinking, it's like this tsunami that just drowns me. But if it's like the cold plunge, like, if I get rejected on something, like if I asked like to do a TED talk or something like that, and I get rejected, it's like, oh my God, this feels so bad. And then it's like, well, you know, well, you don't deserve it anyway. I mean, your book isn't that popular. You don't have a major publisher. Like this is a while ago. Yeah. And it's kind of like, I look at it like, okay, can I just sensation without explanation? Can I just go into the sensation of this? And when I do, it hurts about a million times. It still hurts. Like, it's not like all of a sudden, hallelujah, thank you, Lord, I'm healed. But it does feel like, okay, at least it's one dimensional at that point.
Yeah.
When you have the thoughts and the feeling together, and this is what I call the alarm anxiety cycle. You know, the alarm in your body creates these anxious thoughts in your mind, and the anxious thoughts in your mind aggravate the alarm in your body. And the two of them together, when they mesh together, because you can't see it, it's completely overwhelming. But if you split them up and you start saying, okay, these are the anxious thoughts, over in the other corner, you know, is the feeling in my body. And when you can separate the two, pull them apart, they stop energizing each other and you can see them for what they are. So that's kind of like, that's the whole sensation with that explanation thing. When I get disappointed or whatever. And what I would suggest is like, when you're looking at the phone, like waiting, is he going to text back? It's like, where do I feel this? Like, and when did I feel this in the past? Like, you know, not to get too much into your head and just allow yourself to kind of just put your hand over that area and just like allow it just to be there and just allow it to kind of just metabolize. Because it will if you give it a chance. But if you go into your thoughts, like, what's going to happen? Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? Yeah. We never metabolize it. We never actually change it. And that's why people stay anxious for their whole lives, is they're dealing with this alarm in their body that they're not dealing with and thinking that they can change it just by changing the thoughts of your mind, which doesn't work.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. Yes. And it's been a fascinating, you were talking about like the kind of assuming, you know, kind of waiting. I think, and you talk about this in your book, waiting for the other shoe to drop. It's just this, and I do notice that this is like, and of course not the final piece, because I'm sure there are still many, but it feels like the next piece that I'm working on is, can I stop assuming the outcome? Like, I get into something and it's like, as if before it even starts, I kind of already know how it's going to end.
Right.
In that, you know,
because you make it that way.
Right. And then, of course,
you pull out.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
You do know how it's going to end because you end it.
Yeah. So it's been very interesting to observe. But yes, can I not make it mean something? That was the thing that I would talk about. It's so the same concept phrased differently, because I just noticed how much meaning I put on everything. Mm. And I'm like, what if I don't make it mean anything? Like, what if it just is?
But this is our artistic temperament, though, too. Like, like that's what I like when I talk with Cynthia. Like, Cynthia is a somatic counselor as well, right? So we can get into the heady minutiae of, like, you know, oscillation, pendulation, all this kind of stuff with our clients, patients, whatever you want to call them. But really, it just comes down to, like, can you allow yourself to feel the feeling? And if you can't, then you need someone else to kind of help you. Right. And so many people don't. They don't allow it because it, like you say, it's too vulnerable. I have that too. It's just too vulnerable. And, you know, we get attracted to people, I think, that will help us process our old pain. But the person we're attracted to is also looking at us to help process their pain. Yeah. So then, and then you get into arguments and both of you lose your prefrontal cortex because you're in survival physiology. And both of you turn into 8-year olds and you fight like 8-year olds, and it's not going to go well. You get 2 8-year olds going at each other. Uh-uh. It's not going to resolve very quickly or amicably.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it resolves way quicker than I would like because the person acted like a 5-year old. And I'm like, well, okay, there's that.
Right. Well, Cynthia and I have pictures of ourselves around the house. I'm about 8 or 9, and she's about, I'd say, probably around the same age. And sometimes if we're arguing about something, which doesn't happen that often, but luckily we get a chance to repair reasonably quick, you know, easily and quickly. Good. But I'll go look at that picture, and it's like, this is who I'm dealing with right now. I'm dealing with a 10-year-old girl, right? And then she knows that with me too. Like, I'm dealing with an 8-year-old boy. So it's so much easier to be compassionate to a child than it is to be compassionate to your partner or your spouse or whatever. So I think it's, you know, you've always impressed me as having this artistic temperament. And I think we as artists, we want to know, like we want, and it's kind of like poetry. Like, poetry is about as close to language creating emotion as there is. And I think acting is another way of doing that too. But it's like, can you just, you know, we're good at feeling emotion, us actors. But are we good at feeling it in our own lives? We're good at putting it out there. Like, I would love to. And I think that's why a lot of actors do what they do. I think they have a lot of trauma in general, and they can kind of act it out as another person, right? It's almost perfect. Yeah. But eventually it's going to catch up with you, and you have to deal with it for yourself.
Yep. I agree.
So what's the book about? Like, what's the book before we wrap up? Like, what is the book?
Yes. It is my journey from San Francisco to DC and everywhere in between. And really me over about an 8-year period, just exploring, like, what does this really mean to be free? What does it mean to let go? I mean, I go through partnerships and relationships. I, you know, quit jobs. I start new things. Again, I'm asking some of these big questions, and a lot of what we've talked about in terms of, how can I be with what is without getting into my head? Or how can I just feel the sensation? How can I not make it mean something about me, which are all the stories and the beliefs? Because I think ultimately, for me, the way I think, again, you and I are talking about very, very similar things from different languages and experiences, but it's the things that are keeping me stuck, the things that are trapping me, are my beliefs. It's all the stories in my head that I tell myself about things, which could be anxious thoughts or, you know, other things, but sometimes they just appear as, oh, a thought I'm having or a story or a belief I've held. And it's me throughout the book looking at each one of those and saying, is this really true anymore? Again, without then reactivating, without having to figure it out. And that was actually part of, I talk about this in the preface. I was nearly complete with the book. And then I heard Alan Watts say something about the downfall of mankind was when we became self-aware. Mm. And I thought, oh, shit. Yeah. I did it again. I just got so self-aware that I've now caught myself in a whole nother trap. And I wrote a whole book about it. But I forged ahead. And I realized that like you said, once we're aware of the thing, like being a know-it-all, or for me being hyper self-aware or analytical about everything in my life, because I have such awareness around it, doesn't mean I don't do it anymore, but I was able to do it with a little more grace, a little more humor, a little more compassion for myself. And so I finished the book, and yeah, I'm very, very proud with how it turned out. And so, yes, what it says on the back is it says, true freedom is found in embracing all of it and not believing we can choose our way out of half of it. So it's, we don't get to just have, again, the happy moments that last 16 minutes. And then, you know, we do experience all of it. And I think a lot of, for me, anxiety and other things like that are us trying to avoid half of it.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's one of the issues that I write about too, is that, you know, anxiety is one of those acceptable emotions when you're a child and you're traumatized or you don't see things going the way that you want them to. Anxiety becomes an explanation. And then what we do is we narrow any extreme emotion, love, fear, whatever, and it all gets railroaded down into this path of anxiety. And then you hear people say that, you know, anxiety and excitement are exactly the same in the brain. They're not, but they're close, But that's the thing, is like, we'll allow ourselves to feel anxiety because we're familiar with it, you know, and what human beings equate familiarity with security. So we go back to this feeling of anxiety, which doesn't do us any favors really, because what the anxiety does, what the alarm does in our system, is it just fires us up into more thinking, which is getting us away from the ultimate feeling, which is what we have to process. And the little analogy that I'm working on right now is like, if you had a toaster and the toaster would only work for 3 seconds at a time, and then it would be off for 3 seconds, how long is it going to take you to toast that frickin' piece of bread? It's never going to get toasted because you're going to press it down. It's going to heat up for 3 seconds, then it's going to go down. Then it's going to heat up for 3 seconds. Then it's going to go down. So the analogy, the way that I draw the analogy is, it's like, if you don't actually go into the feeling and stay with the feeling and allow it to toast, you're never going to get a final product that makes any sense. So you're always going to be stuck in your head. And that was me for 30 plus years, right? So I think it's just understanding your own patterns, being compassionate with yourself. Like, one of the things I wrote in the book was ABCs, right? So be aware early, like, okay, I'm watching for this guy's text. Okay, that's my tell. That's my trigger. Okay, now I go into my, instead of like going into my head, I go into my body and my breath at that point. I put my hand over my alarm. I have compassion for myself. I have connection with that little child in me who saw her mom not connected to her dad and doesn't want to repeat that same thing over and over. But again, it's like staying, can I stay with that feeling and just allow the thoughts to come in like a parade? And just allow them to go by, like, don't give them credibility. And it's like the old story that I tell about having 2 15-year-olds in my office, a male and a female. And you know this story, right?
I love
it. I say, hey, Amanda, maybe I shouldn't use Amanda, it was first name. Hey, Jane, you might be pregnant. Now, Jane's going to freak the hell out, right? Now, if I go in and I go say, hey, Jake, you might be pregnant, he's going to just laugh because he doesn't believe the thought, right? So they're just thoughts. Until you believe them. And once you believe them, then that's when they create the alarm. That's when they create the pain. And it's like, the pain is pointing you towards something that you haven't processed yet. So, you know, being able to let go is like being able to allow yourself to go through it. And we need help. Sometimes if you've had like emotional, physical, sexual abuse, you're going to need some help. It's not like something, you know, you can read my book or do my program and it's going to heal you. You're going to need somebody else to re-engage their social engagement system and yours, and you link together and we heal together. And that's the whole paradox, is that we look for someone to help us heal, and the right person can do that, but the wrong person is just going to make things worse until you realize, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yes. That feels very true. I will just say the next book will probably absolutely address this or get into it. But I feel I've come to a point where I can no longer heal what I know I deeply need healing on my own. And I don't mean I need to hire a therapist. I mean, I'm sure that could help, but it's not even that. I mean, having a person in a relationship with me, because that is right now where so much of that like lingering trauma triggers
are. Right.
That I do believe that's where the work really can happen, you know, and in a beautiful way. So yeah, some people, of course, also need therapists. I'm not saying I, you know, never have or never will. It's just in this one area, it's like, ooh, that's going to be the thing. Like,
right.
That might be the only thing that really gets me to a fully, if ever fully, I don't even know if that's even possible, but just getting to a place where I'm less activated than I am now.
Yeah. And so. I do think that there is this sense that we will meet this magical other. And that's all dopamine and oxytocin. Yeah. And for the first 12 weeks, it's amazing. Amazing, you know, because it dulls the pain. It dulls the alarm. But then after 12 weeks, the oxytocin drops, all that kind of stuff. And now you're like, okay, now I'm faced with connection. And this is not safe. If connection isn't safe, it's going to come up. So it's just being able to kind of see that. So it's just, I think really, you know, it's being able to see it so you don't have to be it. And you will keep being it for a long time, but it's just being able to kind of look at it in awareness and like, okay, this is my pattern. Like one of my patterns is a know-it-all, like I said. And it's like, okay, do I have to do that? It's like, no, I can release that. The other thing I used to do all the time is I used to get into the conversation that I was a doctor as early as I possibly could. You know, it could be like, you know, I'm checking in for a flight. It's like, I'm a doctor, you know, that should say Dr. Kennedy, you know? And it's like, now I just watch myself and it's like, I would see the urge to kind of go, if someone says, oh, you know, thanks, Mr. Kennedy. Like it used to be, you know, oh, that's Dr. Kennedy. I didn't go to evil medical school for 6 years to be called Mr. Thank you very much. You know? And now it's like, I notice, I see myself. It's like, yeah, now I don't have to bring that up. I still will sometimes, but I do.
Fascinating. Yeah. Because I didn't realize I lead with, I'm not good at relationships. I get really anxious and really, okay. I see how quickly into meeting somebody, I can tell them that information.
Wow.
So I'm so attached to that identity.
Right.
That of course it is literally the thing inhibiting me from having the experience and relationship I want. So
if you can be aware of that before you're having your next coffee date, that this is what I normally say, and this is the urge that I would have to say it, but where do I feel that sensation? And just, you know, put your hand over it and say, you know, I'm not going to say it this time. I'm just going to see what happens. And your body may freak out because that's your comfort zone, right? But you're also kind of testing the other person. And I think early on, that's how couples form, is they kind of do these unconscious tests back and forth to each other. Like, are you going to help me with my old trauma? Are you going to become this magical other? And I think so often, you know, it's like my old joke about, you know, when your soulmate becomes your cellmate, right? Because you think that this person is going to be like the oh my God, you just got to spend every minute with them. They're amazing. They're fantastic. And then at 12 weeks in, when the oxytocin starts to drop, you start seeing, maybe they shouldn't drink a whole bottle of wine every day. You know, maybe that's just a red flag though, but I really like them. So I'm going to stay here. So again, it's just being able to see that stuff. And you know, it's the old ABCs, like awareness, body and breath. You know, there's no urgency. That's the difference between anxiety and fear. Fear, you know, if there's an elephant going to trample you, you got to get out of the way. You got to do something right now. But anxiety, if you can wait 5 seconds, it's anxiety. It's not fear. And just be aware, you know, of what's happening. And I think, you know, I have to be very grateful to you to, you know, parse out how I had to organize this book, because it was all, as you know, and if you, you know, listen to me for the last 45 minutes, you know that my mind goes everywhere all at once at the same time, right? So you had to kind of go, okay, let's just put this out. And then when you made that outline, and I said this to people, when I send people to Awaken Village Press to work on their books with you, it's like, this is what made the difference. When she made that outline of 108 chapters, well, we made it together, but you kind of took it out. Once I saw the outline, I knew I could write the book. But before that, it was just this huge Mount Everest in front of me. Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to take all these random thoughts that are in my mind and organize them. And then I realized now that 108 chapter structure was the absolute perfect recipe for that book. Like, it was just perfect. But I didn't really see that I could do it until you made the outline for it. So I'm very grateful for you for that. So how do people find you? Or find the book? What's going on these days, Amanda?
Absolutely. Becoming Free is available wherever books are sold online, Amazon or any other online resource.
Amanda Johnson. Not John Stun.
John's son. So look it up wherever you buy your books. Also, if you want to find me on Instagram at being Amanda J or Awaken Village Press, I'm on both of those channels. So come check us out.
Cool. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
You know,
it does still cause me a little bit of anxiety because I know how anxious I was when I wrote the book and how we would have these meetings like this. And it'd be I don't know if this is ever going to get done. I'm just hitting the wall here, that kind of thing. But you were so good at kind of just just feeding me a little bit. It's like, okay, we'll take a break and then we'll come back in a week and we'll do this. But you always gave me these manageable bites to do, and I was always able to do it. So, one of the reasons I'm in the position I'm in now is because of you, and I'm very grateful to you, Amanda. Thank you so much.
My sincere pleasure. It's truly been an honor to not only partner with you then, and then to now watch it grow and evolve. It is truly magnificent. And I now get to say that if one person can do it, more of us can. And of course, you've put in a lot of energy, a lot of effort, and, I'm just happy that it's paid off and other people are getting to benefit from it. So truly
amazing. And I'm glad other people are getting benefit from you, Amanda.
Yes, absolutely. So. And thank you for all those that you connect us with. We'll have another book coming out of a woman who also was inspired by your book. So I'm sure hers will come out later this year. And so again, people are, they're enjoying your book so much that they're actually finding their way to me, which has been awesome. So thank you. Yeah.
Well, it all comes full circle, doesn't it?
Sure does. Yes, it does. So thank you for having me on. And again, thank you for all those listening. And go grab a copy of Becoming Free. I think you'll be glad you did. And if you don't already have Anxiety RX, obviously get a copy of that too.
And get a copy of the new one too when it comes out.
Definitely. Maybe both. We'll get one of both. Yep. Yeah. Then you can compare them.
You can get both.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, they're actually very different books. So I'm glad that they're that they're coming out. So
I'll get the next one and see how it differs. So anyway,
thank you, Amanda, and we will talk again soon.
Yes, we will. All right,
bye for now.
See ya. Bye.
So that's it for today's episode. Thanks for listening, and if the Anxiety RX podcast resonates with you, consider getting my book, also coincidentally called Anxiety RX. Or you can follow me on any of the social media platforms at The Anxiety MD or my website, www.theanxietymd.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you the next time on the Anxiety RX podcast.